Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and let's listen now to the voice of one brave heart in Ferguson, Missouri.
Michael's going to make it better for our sons so they can be better black men. So they can be better for our daughters so they can be better black women. Better for me so I can be a better black father. And we know they're going to make our mamas even better than they are today.
Can the creative spirit of people working together push back the forces of violence and chaos? That's our focus this hour on a Monday of hope and caution around the nation and the world. In addition to the developments in Ferguson, we will explore the illicit organ trade, global organ trade, with a New York Times investigative reporter. And we will consider the collaborative power of the Beatles, four young men working together whose creativity is revealed by a creative dad's music mix. Stay tuned for that later this hour. But first, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon has called out the National Guard to Ferguson after there were more violent protests, including reports of firebombs and gunfire targeting local officers. The rioting was answered with hundreds of officers firing rubber bullets and tear gas. During the daylight hours, Captain Ron Johnson of the Missouri Highway Patrol, whose voice you heard a moment ago, and who has taken over the local police operation, was working crowds in Ferguson appealing for peace. Here he is before a packed audience at the Greater Grace Church.
I want to start off by talking to Mike Brown's family. And I want you to know my heart goes out to you. And I say that I'm sorry. I wear this uniform. And I should stand up here and say that I'm sorry.
Captain Johnson urged people to embrace law enforcement as a part of the community and not as an invasion force.
This is my neighborhood. You are my family, you are my friends, and I am you. And I will stand and protect you. I will protect your right to protest. And I'm telling you right now, I'm full right now. I came in here today and I saw people cheering and people clapping, and this is what the media needs to put on TV.
But over the weekend, citizens were angrily reacting to the release of surveillance video, which police said shows a looming 6'4" Michael Brown shoving a convenience store clerk and stealing shortly before his death, although the officer identified in the Brown shooting was apparently not answering any robbery call. In addition, a preliminary private autopsy revealed that Brown was shot 6 times, including twice in the head. Joining us now is St. Louis Public Radio reporter Jason Rosenbaum. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So give me a sense, what do people feel they need more of? Captain Johnson's spirit there or the National Guard to keep order on the streets in Ferguson?
Boy, that's a really good question. I was actually at that rally sitting about 5 feet away from Captain Johnson. And I don't use these words lightly. It was an unbelievable speech that brought the capacity crowd to its feet. And it seemed from that moment, maybe we had turned a corner here in the St. Louis area after days of discord and violence. But after about 9:30, things just spiraled completely out of control. The words that both Captain Johnson and everybody else at that church spoke seemed to be a distant memory, with just tear gas and broken windows and every other force of destruction you can imagine. And as soon as I saw the TV screens after coming back from that rally, I knew that it was an inevitability that the National Guard was going to be called. And as you mentioned, the governor of Missouri did that earlier this morning.
Well, I want to talk in a moment about what the National Guard can do that the very militarized-looking police weren't able to do in Ferguson last week. But give us a sense of the state of the investigation at this point. Federal authorities, local authorities, where does that stand?
Well, as you kind of mentioned, a private autopsy came out. The New York Times reported on that. There are dozens of FBI agents combing Ferguson, asking for information. There's a local investigation that's being done by St. Louis County, which, by the way, is under fire by various political leaders and people within this protest. And, you know, people want quick action for this, but the reality is these investigations take a lot of time to complete. There's a lot of witnesses that need to be talked to and a lot of evidence that has to kind of be looked at by investigators. And the people that want, you know, an immediate indictment or some sort of action, I just don't think they're getting that right now. And I don't think they're going to get that just because of the way investigations work.
Back to the National Guard. What is the capability and credibility of the Guard here? And what can they do that law enforcement wasn't able to accomplish last week? Any sense?
That's going to be the real unknown here. I mean, with each passing day, it's kind of escalated and escalated. It started off where, you know, the county and a bunch of municipalities responded to the rioting. Then St. Louis County basically took over. And on Wednesday, obviously, their response made international news. Then the Highway Patrol took over. And it seemed like it was going okay on Thursday, but on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, it just wasn't happening. And I don't think people know what to expect with the National Guard. This is a military force that is usually used to either respond to natural disasters here, or in some cases they're jettisoned out to foreign conflicts. And I don't really know what the reaction to the crowd is going to be. I know for the people that are protesting peacefully and vigorously, I mean, I don't think that's going to make them, you know, more violent or anything, because they haven't been violent to begin with. But the people that are, you know, adamantly trying to confront governmental authorities, of the people that are out there at night, it's just going to be a real unknown how they're going to respond to this new, you know, force that's going to be on the ground.
In the last minute, Jason, some have described this as really evidence of an all-out assault on young black males. Any sense that this could spread to other communities in the St. Louis area, or is it confined to Ferguson at this point?
I don't know if it's going to spread to other communities, but I can tell you just from my reporting, the people that I've talked to that have been protesting, some of them are from Ferguson, but a lot of them are from the surrounding communities, which are either partially or predominantly African American. This is now, I think, stretched beyond Ferguson's borders and is now not only an entire St. Louis issue, but I think, as you're saying, it's become national and international. And, you know, these types of situations have been brewing for a long time in St. Louis, and now they're on display for the national and international media to behold.
Jason Rosenbaum giving us a sense of what's going on in Ferguson and the entire St. Louis area. He's a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We want to talk now to someone on the front lines of the struggle to hold this community together. He has no badge or body armor. The Reverend Steve Lawler is the rector of St. Stephen's Episcopal Church in Ferguson. Welcome, Reverend.
Thank you.
How are you and your congregation responding to the events in Ferguson?
It's very fluid, and so a lot of what goes on is moment to moment. Yesterday was a really busy day. We have become a food collection place, so the parish hall is filling up with food. People from all over the community are ready to help out. And a couple of quick stories. One, a very small, I'm saying three-year-old girl who was came by with her grandmother, and she's got, you know, a can in hand and a crayon drawing of people eating. And then the other was the other day, a man whose son was murdered a couple, probably 2.5 years ago, and him coming and just the depth of his compassion for the family, for the police officers, for the community, for the neighborhoods. I mean, just completely from a compassionate place. And he too had, you know, bagged food. So I would say the congregation's been really great and responsive. I would say, like the community, a number of people, myself included, are starting to feel some of the fatigue. The shock came immediately, but the fatigue, I think, is there now more for more people.
Reverend, in your church building on Sunday and during the events in Ferguson over the last week, as you look out to the people and the crowds that have come to rely on your church, what are you seeing in the faces?
Well, I mentioned fatigue. I would say the other thing is that there are a lot of different stories, a lot of different narratives about what's going on, and people are heartbroken and also are ready to say they just don't know. This is such a dynamic situation, such a different thing. And so I would say I'm seeing more people feel the kind of shock and also feel the kind of confusion about what happens next.
Are you seeing white faces and black faces with the same kinds of questions?
Yes, absolutely. I would say the people who are on the ground in Ferguson, who live in Ferguson, are sharing many of the same questions and many of the same gatherings. There's a lot of different responses and everything from, you know, we've got to get the violence part settled down. We've got to figure out how to manage that to, I don't understand how people would do that. I don't understand why somebody would loot. I don't understand why these small business owners are being the victims. And overall, I'd say people's sense about the shooting is that it will probably be really hard, but it will be good when the grand jury makes its findings known so that that next big step can be taken.
Reverend Lawler, is this a divided community, Ferguson? And how are you doing personally in all of this?
Oh, thanks for asking that. The community is not divided in most ways. So I think it's a community that has a history of being multiracial. I think if you were at the protests or the 4th of July parade, you know, a month or so ago, if you were at the farmers market, most places you go in Ferguson are multiracial, and most neighborhoods are. There are some pocket neighborhoods that are probably predominantly black and some that are predominantly white. And I think this kind of experience has been really hard for the folks who are very active in those various connective tissue kinds of organizations in town. But clearly, for a part of the community, this is what's happened when there hasn't been the right kind of relationships between the police and the community. You know, I think this would be awful in any community, but I think it's really heightened that for a part of the community, the level of distrust is very high. So it doesn't take a stretch for people to see that this is a pattern, not just a single incident. There's some hope, but I think it's also each night that we have destruction and violence is a real setback, because we're looking for things that will start the process of really working out what justice looks like in this and what peace looks like in this and what moving forward looks like in this.
Reverend Steve Lawler, take care of yourself, and thanks so much for speaking with us.
All right. Thank you for your interest.
Reverend Steve Lawler is the rector of St. Stephen's Episcopal Church in Ferguson, Missouri. Here's some of what you're saying about the events in Ferguson. Ed from New Jersey writes, instead of giving the legal system a chance to work, everyone, protesters, politicians, community leaders, activists, and the media have made the decision the police were wrong. The damage to local businesses has gotten little coverage, and no matter what the facts show, there will be lasting negative effects on this community. One of you in Greenfield, South Dakota says, law enforcement is here to protect the government and business interests, not the public at large. There is little to no positive relationship between civilians and their police, at least in major cities, according to this perspective. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to join the conversation. We always invite you to be a part of our response network. You can sign up for our texts. You'll get one text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program so your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. All you have to do is text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply here. You can reply STOP to opt out. And now we have a story about how the pressures of supply and demand have always confounded efforts to control human behavior. Simple demand explains the persistent black markets for drugs, prostitution, and gambling. But when a person is facing death unless they get an organ transplant, they can be expected to do virtually anything to get an available organ. The World Health Organization estimates that the supply of available organs only fills about a tenth of the worldwide demand. And in the case of kidneys, intense demand coupled with a restricted supply practically guarantees that a price can be found to tempt a healthy person to give up a kidney and a sick person who needs one to pay that price. New York Times investigative reporter Kevin Sachs spent a year in the netherworld of desperation, ruthlessness, and tragedy that is the illicit kidney market. His profile of the kidney trade in Israel is a case of market economics trumping any sense of morality or the rule of law.
We decided that the most effective way to explain to readers how organ trafficking works was to take a single case study. So the network that I looked at was one in which mostly Israeli recipients, although not exclusively, engaged Israeli brokers who sent them to Costa Rica, where they were hooked up with a prominent nephrologist there, who in turn had a system of finding donors among poor Costa Ricans who, just as those who need organs are desperate, these recipients are very desperate too, almost always in some sort of significant economic distress. And they were paid for their kidneys.
And this trafficking and these transplants were hidden in a whole industry of medical tourism in Costa Rica for things that are perfectly legal, like root canals and tummy tucks and plastic surgery, right?
Exactly. Costa Rica has developed a really sophisticated medical tourism industry over the last decade. Because of that, they've got an infrastructure there. They have several private hospitals that are accustomed to dealing with foreign patients. The other thing that sort of drives it from Costa Rica's angle is a real financial incentive for the doctors and hospitals that are involved. Doctors in Costa Rica, or at least specialists like nephrologists and transplant surgeons, are assigned to one of the country's public hospitals where they receive a salary, and it's not a particularly high salary, certainly not compared to their American counterparts. But there are also private hospitals where they can work after hours, and there they're paid by the case. So the more foreign patients they bring into those hospitals, the more they make.
The mechanism in Costa Rica for – or mechanisms in Costa Rica for harvesting the kidneys are amazing. I mean, one in particular involved a taxi driver named Mrs. Cordero.
There were two recruiters that the nephrologist in this case, Dr. Mora, had connections to. One was, in fact, Ms. Cordero, who was a police officer by day and a taxi driver by night. And, yes, she occasionally would solicit fares in her cab to become donors. She would start conversations with them, according to the prosecutors down there, find out that they had some sort of financial need, and then would eventually connect them to Dr. Mora. The other recruiter owned a pizza place across the street from the public hospital where Dr. Mora worked. And he, according to his attorney, received a call several years ago from a relative in the United States who needed a kidney. He started asking around among doctors who were his customers and was eventually referred to Dr. Mora.
How much does a kidney cost in these networks, as you discovered?
It varies. The people that are paying for the transplants would pay anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000, although we actually found a gentleman from Texas who had arranged to pay $330,000 for a transplant. The amount that goes to the donor, the quote-unquote donor, is a small fraction of that.
In the course of your investigation, if it is the case that you can't put a price on life, did you at any point find yourself sympathetic with people who claim they're helping people to live, whatever the cost and whatever the tactics?
I felt very sympathetic for the patients who felt they had no choice other than to buy organs in order to live. Certainly the brokers all argue the same case that you just made, that they are saving lives, that they're filling unmet need. That said, they're making huge amounts of money. They are motivated at least equally by greed as by any good intentions.
What are the authorities doing about this in Israel and Costa Rica and even globally?
There are ongoing investigations in both of those countries. I expect indictments pretty soon in Costa Rica against the doctors and recruiters that were involved down there. Israeli prosecutors are also looking at the brokers. So I do expect there to be action soon. Worldwide, it's very difficult to make these cases, and there really have only been a handful over the last decade, decade and a half of significant prosecutions.
How would you characterize the exploitation and victimization of the donors in these cases?
They obviously go in with their eyes partially open, but only partially. There is oftentimes very little discussion of the medical risks that they would face. There's very little discussion of the aftercare they need. And there is, you know, as with any significant surgery, a risk of death and injury. And typically folks do not know much about that.
Well, it's a really sad global story of desperation and victimization and, you know, greed. Costa Rica has recently cracked down on this. Do you suspect that it will just pop up somewhere else?
That's been the history. It's been impossible because of the terrible inequity between supply and demand. It's been just impossible to smother this kind of activity. And typically when one country cracks down, the brokers find another one that's willing to take them. There's too much money involved for them not to find a place to go.
Kevin Sack, investigative correspondent for our partner at the New York Times, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
One more thought now about the shortage of transplant organs and the desperate measures people resort to obtain one. If you can't beat supply and demand with morality and legal restrictions, one approach is to just embrace it. Iran is the only country worldwide where the practice of selling one's kidneys for profit is legal and regulated. It's also one of the only places that claims to have no waiting list for organs. Dr. Benjamin Hippen is a transplant nephrologist in Charlotte, North Carolina. He studied the Iranian kidney market. Welcome.
Thank you.
So Iran set this up in the late 80s, and there's a whole big, long story of how that happened. But in the intervening time, we've had a chance to study it. What are the advantages and disadvantages of the Iranian approach?
I think the advantages of the Iranian approach is, if their data is to be believed, they've managed to eliminate the waiting list. The system of compensation for donors in Iran began in the late 1980s, primarily because of financial exigencies in that country. They were unable to provide, through their socialized healthcare system, dialysis therapy for everyone who needed it. Concomitantly, they did not have much of a deceased donor program, primarily because at the time, the Iranian legislature did not recognize brain death as death. However, by 1999, through their system, they were able to eliminate the waiting list. I should say that that doesn't mean that there's no one in Iran who's on dialysis. What that actually means in Iran is that about 45% of patients with kidney failure actually have a transplant.
Is this a collaboration of religious authorities and the medical community in Iran to make this marketplace work and come up with the regulations?
The cooperation with religious authorities primarily took on a new dimension in 2000 when the Iranian legislature recognized brain death as death. In one of history's odd apercues, this was actually a cause dear to the heart of the late Ayatollah Khomeini, who was quite interested in brain death. And it was through his efforts primarily that that was recognized in 2000. I should say, too, that in the Iranian system, they've set it up so that those who are not Iranian nationals, either donors or recipients, are at least ostensibly prohibited from participating in it, though there are a few case reports of people coming from outside of Iran who are not Iranian nationals participating in it.
All right. So the takeaway is they bring the illicit market to the surface and make it legal. And they also restrict access of foreign nationals. So you can't have the brokers like we've discovered in Israel. What are the potential downsides and who's likely to get exploited by a system like this?
I think the most concerning downside of the Iranian system is the fact that the vast majority of compensated donors in Iran are disproportionately poor. But the other major concern about the Iranian system is the lack of long-term follow-up of these donors. The salient concern with regard to donation is what happens to people 10 and 20 and 30 years down the road. And there's plenty of literature from studies of organ trafficking that suggests that the long-term outcomes for people selling their kidneys, particularly on the black market, are very poor.
So if we were to adopt a system like this in the United States, at the very least, you would want to have some sort of program that would allow for continual follow-up of donors so that their health can be maintained and preserved.
Yes. What we favor is a system of incentives that maintains the existing regulatory framework for the long-term follow-up of living donors. So uncompensated living donors in the United States, for example, have to go through an entire evaluation process on the medical surgical side and currently require 2 years of follow-up after donation. We would actually favor extending that. And we think that by avoiding the use of donors who are otherwise high risk, say those who are older who have high blood pressure or diabetes or the like, we could actually create a system that is ostensibly safer for living donors, but in the short and the long term, than the current system is now.
Some lessons from Iran with the prospect of improving that system here in the United States. Dr. Benjamin Hippen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Benjamin Hippen is a transplant nephrologist who studied the Iranian kidney market. He spoke to us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Next up, a father gives a special mixtape to his child as a way of imparting some wisdom about life. And Soundcheck's John Schaefer reviews Ethan Hawke's Black Album. featured in the new movie, Boyhood.
This is not just a mixtape. This is an old-school, free-form, late-night FM college DJ putting together the most awesome set of songs that he or she can imagine.
That conversation coming up, and we're asking you, if you could set your family story to music in a single track, what would you choose? From Oklahoma City, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, ups, downs, fast parts, slow parts, sad and fun, whole array of flavors rolled into one beautiful mess.
This is Joe Macrina from Rent the Mass. If I were to set my my family story to song, it would be You Can't Always Get What You Want by the Rolling Stones. When my kids were young and didn't want to go here or there, or they wanted this or that, I would break into song and start singing, You can't always get what you want. And it stopped them in their tracks. And as the years went by, they just stopped asking, I'm sure, so that they didn't have to hear me sing.
A lighter spirit in Eugene, Oregon, the Benny Hill song. Our family and our best friends would put this song on every holiday season and run around like crazy people. 8778, My Take is our number. What's your song? There's much more at thetakeaway.org. We don't review record releases on this show very often, but we're going to make an exception today.
Open it up. I call that the Beatles Blackout. Best of John, Paul, George, and Ringo, solo, post-breakup.
Thanks. Yeah, basically I put the band back together for you. You know, when you ever listen to too much of the solo stuff, it kind of becomes a drag, you know?
But you put them next to each other, and they start to elevate each other. It's the Beatles.
If you saw the amazing movie Boyhood, you know this moment where Ethan Hawke gives his son in the movie a music mix he calls the Black Album. A dad trying to impart wisdom to his child plays old school FM DJ in three CDs worth of music.
Top of Volume 2, first four tracks. You got Band on the Run, Into My Sweet Lord, Into Jealous Guy, Into Photograph. Come on! It's like the perfect segue. You got Paul takes you to the party. George talks to you about God. John who says, no, it's about love and pain. And then Ringo who just says, hey, enjoy what we have while we have it.
Well, the rain exploded with a mighty crash as we fell into the sun. Really want to see you, Lord, but it takes so long, my sweet Lord. I didn't mean to hurt you. I'm sorry that I made you cry.
Every time I see your face, it reminds me of the places we used to go.
The lesson here? That each individual Beatles' work, carefully and meticulously collected and organized, magically reveals the creative power of collaboration and the miraculous synergy of the original Fab Four. Actor Ethan Hawke actually did this in real life for his daughter, and director Richard Linklater made it part of the movie Boyhood, which got good reviews on this show some weeks back. Today we review the Black Album with our own old-school FM DJ, John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC.
The idea is that the Beatles were more than the sum of their parts, and that apart, they are somewhat less than themselves. And that by putting them together this way, by juxtaposing the best of their individual songs, they buttress each other and they complement each other, even as they sometimes contrast with each other. There's a good example in the second of the three CDs where you hear John Lennon, a kind of a deep cut from him,
right,
called Crippled Inside, which
right,
has a very kind of gut bucket American sound to it. That is adjacent to Ringo Starr's You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine, a song that I've always thought was in questionable taste. But here, next to this kind of John Lennon song, the kind of American roots feel of the Ringo song comes out in a way that I had never experienced
so
before.
So first the deep cut, and then the much more familiar Ringo tune.
You can hide your face behind a smile. One thing you can't hide is when you're crippled inside. You come on like a dream, features in green, lips like strawberry wine. You're 16, you're beautiful.
These pairings are great. What's another one?
Well, you know, there are a number of there's a moment where he brings Paul McCartney's Pipes of Peace and John Lennon's Imagine together, you know, two songs about love and peace. Mull of Kintyre by Paul McCartney is right next to John Lennon's O Yoko. Both songs have a kind of folk song quality to them. Again, something that in the John Lennon case isn't really obvious until you put it next to Mull of Kintyre, which sounds like an old Scottish folk song or something like that.
Part of this is kind of an old radio thing in the sense that DJs love to talk about their segues. And I can see it right on your face.
This is exactly what this – this is not just a mixtape.
Right.
This is an old school – freeform late night FM college DJ.
There you go.
Putting together the most awesome set of songs that he or she can imagine. I have a few quibbles. You know, Ethan Hawke says to his son's character in the film that this is the best of the four of them post Beatles. Where is 1985 by Paul McCartney? Mm-hmm. Where is Whatever Gets You Through the Night by John Lennon?
Gotcha.
Where's Living in the Material World by George? There are a couple of things I really wish were in here. But by the end, the beauty of his concept becomes apparent at the final CD, the end of the third of the three CDs, in this really extraordinary moment where you have Paul McCartney's Here Today, his song about his love and relationship for John after he'd been killed, juxtaposed with George Harrison's All Things Must Pass.
And if I say I really loved you and was glad you came along, then you were here today. Ooh. You were in my song. All things must pass. All things must pass away.
All things must pass following Here Today from Paul McCartney. That would be a real great weepy place to leave us. But he doesn't leave us there. There's a little musical coda, which is Paul McCartney in an MTV Unplugged show doing a version of And I Love Her, as if to say, after everything, after the bitterness, after the strife, after all of that, something endures, and it's the music, and it's a great old Beatles classic that endures. It's not the Beatles playing it. And it's a slightly different tempo and a slightly different rhythm, but it is that great old Beatles tune. And it's as if Ethan Hawke is saying something of the Beatles survives the four of them.
A love like ours.
The hope is that in the larger context of what he's talking about, of love and regret and guilt and remorse and all of that, that something endures from that process as well.
It's a beautiful acoustic song, and it's a great coda. And as Ethan Hawke says to his son, you are the music of whatever happened in our relationship, referring to his own marriage.
Mm-hmm. And let's also remember, he calls this the Black Album. It's the counterpart to the White Album, which was the sound of a band falling apart. And the Black Album, in a sense, is the sound of one man putting that band back together in his imagination and now in our ears.
If we yearned for the Beatles to get back together, does the Black Album deliver that?
Oh, that's a big question. I would say no, because I think at the end of the day, that is in fact not the intent of the Black Album. The intent is exactly what the fictional character is saying in the Linkletter film, because this was something that Ethan Hawke did in real life for his daughter. So this is very much about family and about the passing of time and about the passing of your love of music, of your family, or whatever, on to your children and to the rest of your family. And that, on that level, it works.
John Schaefer, thanks so much.
John, thank you.
John Schaefer is the host of Soundcheck and New Sounds at our partner station WNYC. To see the full list of tracks on the Black Album, go to our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.